Phil Muscatello and FinPods are authorized reps of MoneySherpa. The information in this podcast is general in nature and doesn't take into account your personal situation.
Shares for beginners. Weekend watch list.
G'day and welcome back to Shares for Beginners Weekend Watch List, where we take a close look at an individual company that you may wish to consider for your watch list. It's not a recommendation to buy, but a way for you to learn how Stockopedia screens for value. And joining me today, as usual, is Chris Batchelor, and we're talking Monash IVF, ASX code MVF. G'day, Chris.
Hi, Phil. Good to be with you again today.
So I guess it's all in the name, but enlighten us further on Monash IVF.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, exactly. They're involved in vitro fertilization. Their primary business is around IVF. They also have some ancillary businesses around ultrasounds and genetic testing, obviously things that are related to that whole process of ultimately bringing new children into the world.
It was interesting. I was reading in the annual report that genetic testing has actually increased and has been able to drive an increase in the number of successful pregnancies.
Yeah, that's right. There's been a big push on that. What they're doing is screening for certain conditions prior to someone getting pregnant. And then, of course, that person is able to make more informed decisions as to whether they go down that path and potentially look into treatments if there are issues that they might be facing. And the government have recently introduced more funding to assist with this and more Medicare rebates and rebates from the New South Wales government as well to try and really drive this sort of area because preventative health is often a lot better than more reactive health.
So remind listeners of the Stockopedia NAPS portfolio and the place of Monash as a representative of the healthcare sector.
Yeah, sure. So the NAPS portfolio is a portfolio that we initially set up at the start of 2023. So it's in its second year now. And what we do is at the start of each year, calendar year, we choose 20 stocks, a broad spread across the different sectors in the market. And we look for the highest ranked stocks using the Stockopedia stock ranking methodology, two stocks from each sector. Now, Monash made the cut for the healthcare sector back in 2023. And then when we reviewed the portfolio at the start of this year, it was also one of the top two. So we retained it within the portfolio and we actually had to reweight it. So we had to sell some and lower our holding because we'd made such a strong gain over the last year. And it's actually the third highest performer for the portfolio. It's at 49% over the period since January of last year.
Wow, a real success story.
Indeed, yes.
So what are the four areas that Monash are focusing on in order to increase their market share?
Yeah, so they are able to focus or they need to focus on four key areas. The first, they're what's commonly referred to as a roll-up. So it's a strategy whereby often a medical type businesses acquire other practices or other clinics within that space. And that gives them the benefit of economies of scale. So they can consolidate all those sort of back office type functions, from support functions, accounting, et cetera, and then they can also consolidate their marketing to give them more clout in the market, and they can share expertise across all the various practices that they are able to acquire. So they engage in that. They're acquiring additional practices each year. They usually get a couple more practices to add to their portfolio. The next thing they do is they look to attract more fertility specialists. One of the main constraints in terms of how many clients can they serve is how many doctors do they have available. So they are looking to make their value proposition a really attractive one so as to recruit high quality fertility specialists. So they get new doctors in two ways. One, if you buy a practice, usually those doctors come across. But secondly, they actively recruit for new people. And I think they added another 9 people across last year. The third area that they cover is they use science and technology. And that's beyond my understanding, but basically they're trying to really understand the whole process that's involved in the IVF and leading to success. And that has meant that over the last 6 years, they've been able to grow from a bit over 32% success rate to almost 39%. So that's a marked difference. And obviously, it's a good thing to be able to improve that success rate. And so they're always looking to advance the science to try and improve the outcomes. And the last one, as I hinted at with the acquiring of new practices, is as you get more scale, you can take advantage of marketing more, and they're able to now market their business on a national basis or on a regional basis. You know, at the moment, they're trying to push heavily into Western Australia. They have a budget to be able to do that and just to build brand awareness. So as if you go online looking for IVF services, chances are their name will come up.
The real growth driver, of course, is the rising maternal birth age. And I was a bit astounded that one in 18 children now are IVF babies.
Yes, I was astounded when I read that too. And yes, that's right. I think it, over the last few years, the birth rate, the average birth age has increased by 2 years. And that, of course, means that the chances of conceiving naturally are declining. Once a woman passes 35, her fertility declines. And so there's more and more need to use IVF to try and bring about a successful pregnancy.
And there's technological advances as well. Like another one that they've mentioned in the annual report is the awareness of freezing eggs for future use.
Yeah, that's right. That's actually a significant part of their business. And yeah, that's becoming more common. Again, people are aware that as they age, their chances of conceiving naturally decline. Now with technology, you're able to freeze your eggs. So for example, you might freeze them when you're around the age of 30, but choose to have a child at 35. As far as the eggs are concerned and their chances of being fertilized, it's the same as if you're still 30. But there's no guarantees that these processes will work.
They also have an imaging business, ultrasounds, I believe. Is that a contributor to the revenue?
It's a significant contributor to the revenue. They don't actually break out exactly how much, but it's clear that it does make a substantial contribution. They have 15 ultrasound clinics across 3 states. So yeah, that's also a significant part of the business.
So that's when you go and have a look at the baby kicking in utero and whether it's going to be a boy or a girl.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, a process that pretty much every pregnant woman goes through. So, yeah, there's a clear connection there with the IVF side of the business.
Are you picking shares on gut instinct, buying on press tips or rumours? Do you struggle to find the time to keep up with the research and analysis that goes into evaluating potential stocks? Stockopedia are pleased to offer a special deal to listeners of this podcast, a 14-day free trial and a 10% discount on the first year of membership. Sign up now at y.stockopedia.com/sfb. There's no better time to access the most comprehensive, easy-to-use investing toolbox for DIY share investors. 10% off, 14-day free trial and a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's y.stockopedia.com/sfb.
Monash IVF are also expanding into Southeast Asia. How's that expansion going?
Yes, they are. They have a small presence in Southeast Asia, in Singapore, 2 clinics in Malaysia, and 2 in Indonesia, although 1 is only minority owned. So far, they haven't had the success in Southeast Asia that they have experienced here in Australia. The growth has been a lot slower. And in fact, over the last half year, it was a negative contribution to EBITDA, mainly due to a bit of a slowdown in Kuala Lumpur. However, they're optimistic that things will turn around in that market, particularly Singapore. It seems to be going quite well. So, yeah, they are focusing somewhat on that area, but it is a relatively small component of the business. In fact, of their revenue last year, I think 12 million came from Southeast Asia as opposed to 200 million from Australia.
So let's dive deeper into the financials. What are they looking like? I mean, obviously, their performance in the NAPS portfolio indicates that they're pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. They are looking very attractive. And particularly the most recent half-year results came in with very strong numbers. Revenue was up 22% in the first half of financial year 24, which obviously is very strong. Profits were also up similar magnitude. EBITDA, EBIT, no matter how you look at it, the profits were very strong. What they call underlying net profit after tax was up 19%. And interestingly enough, the management had forecast that their profits would come in between 15 and 19%, and they came in at 18.7%, so right at the very top end of that range. And the forecast that management are making and the market agrees with this is that those profits will continue to grow. They're looking at a strong second half. And a lot of this stuff, they have pretty good visibility ahead. Obviously, this is a process that takes time. So they have 11% growth in their new patients over the last half. So those people will start to take on treatments over the coming months. They're also seeing growth, as we mentioned, with the genetic screening. Seen 160% growth since the rebate was introduced in, I think it was November of last year. And they've also got the new clinics that they've acquired. One that was only acquired just this month, settled just this month. That will also add to their bottom line. So good growth prospects moving into the second half of the year.
Chris, can we just dive a little bit deeper into NPAT? Because what I've noticed in annual reports, management sometimes focuses on different metrics, but they seem to be very proud of their NPAT. What is it about this particular metric that they like and is important for listeners to consider when valuing a company?
Yeah, NPAT stands for net profit after tax. It really is the most important measure of earnings. There's a number of measures of earnings, and basically the way they work is that you come down the income statement and you gradually eliminate different factors. But when you get to net profit after tax, you've eliminated everything, and it really is the money that goes to the owners of the business. So it's after tax, as the name suggests, but also after interest has been paid, after depreciation, after amortization. So it's the final bottom line of how much money did the business make.
So what's the difference then between NPAT and EBITDA?
So EBITDA stands for earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, amortization. So it's that before and after are really the two key terms in those descriptions. But EBITDA is a measure of sort of what we would call a higher line of profit. It's an interesting figure. It's close to what you earn in terms of cash, but it's not the true picture in terms of the expenses that the business has to pay out. Whilst depreciation might be a non-cash item, it is something that's relevant if your equipment gradually declines in value or in effectiveness over time. You're going to have to replace it. So prudent business is setting aside money for that. Obviously, if you've got any borrowings, you have to pay interest on those. If you're making any money, then you're going to have to pay tax. So as we go down the income statement, we account for all of those different factors, and then we get to NPAT, which is our bottom line. That's what we've earned, what we can either pay out to shareholders or reinvest in the business.
Great explanation. So this is scoring, I'm not sure whether the term is high or low, but it's scoring in Stockopedia as a bankruptcy risk. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I will indeed. And that's the first thing you notice when you're looking at this stock. I often start by studying the balance sheet, because if I think a business is too risky, well, there's no point investigating any further. I'm going to move on to something else. And so when I first looked at this, and you look at the bankruptcy risk, it's in the cautious zone. And so I wanted to understand, well, why is that? What's going on there? And in this particular case, I believe that there's two reasons. One is that they have a large negative retained earnings balance. So what that means is each time you make a loss as a business, you include that on your balance sheet, and you have to then make that back in future profits before you have a positive, what we call retained earnings. Now, in the case of Monash, they've got this large negative retained earnings balance. However, it's from business operations more than 10 years ago. They've been making profits every year for the last 10 years. So whilst they're still carrying that, it's not affecting their day-to-day operations in the present. So I'm not too concerned about that. I'm quite happy to discount that. The other one, which is on the face value more concerning, is that their current liabilities are higher than their current assets. And when we say use the term current, it means things that are going to come due in the next 12 months. And so when you look on their balance sheet, you see that they had a large amount of borrowings, $43 million, that was due very soon, within the next 12 months. However, that was as at the 31st of December last year. Now, when they released their results on the 23rd of February, so 6-7 weeks later, they had actually renegotiated that debt facility, and it had been extended to February of 2027. So we now know that there's no need to be alarmed about that debt, that it's all under control. However, at the 31st of December, without that subsequent knowledge, you could legitimately be concerned that, you know, if they had to pay that back by February this year, then they might have been in a bit of bother. But we know they don't have to. So I'm not too concerned about that bankruptcy risk, despite the initial appearance of it being in the cautious zone.
So any final thoughts, Chris?
One thing that it's worth noting with this stock when you look at it is the, well, there's actually two things I'll point out. One is the return on equity and return on capital. It's not great, but it's not terrible. The return on equity is 8.8%. Ideally, I'm looking for businesses with more than 10%, but, you know, just under 9 is kind of getting pretty close. So that's something just to bear in mind. And then the other thing is the valuation. It's not cheap. The value score in Stockopedia is 50, so right on average, but it's not hugely expensive either. The PE ratio is 18, price to book is 2, price to sales is 2.5. So, yeah, a little bit on the high side, but not excessive. So they're just a couple of things to bear in mind. I should also add that I do own this stock, so just putting that out there, just disclosing that.
And it's also a reasonable value metric as well, because sometimes we look at good companies on this podcast and their value scores is, you know, 6 or something. But I think this is 50 at the moment, somewhere around the 50 mark.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, at 50, it's quite reasonable. It's not fantastic, but it's quite reasonable. It has had a very strong run. As we mentioned when talking about the NAPS portfolio, a 49% return is very good. That gives it a momentum score of 99, almost as high as you can get. There's no particular reason to think that won't continue. Not that that's any promise or anything. It may not, but it has had a strong run and that's impacted the value score.
Chris Batchelor, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Phil. As always, great to be with you.
Thanks for listening to Shares for Beginners. You can find more at sharesforbeginners.com. If you enjoy listening, please take a moment to rate or review in your podcast player, or tell a friend who might want to learn more about investing for their future.